Hey, welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. One of my favorite things about working at the BPP is that someone's always got your back. Times of trouble and strife, someone's always there for you, holding out the little trampoline in case you jump off the high wire. This is the context in which we enter the next segment.
We are not those people.
Yes, but you are too. You better be. Otherwise, who are you?
I left my trampoline at the desk.
Ian Chillog and Matt Martinez have joined me in studio for a little something we like to call the ramble. What you got, Mr. Chillog?
Okay. Harrison Ford is nothing more than a running dog of the CIA.
What?
According to unhappy members of the Communist Party in Russia, where the newest Indiana Jones feature has just opened. Now, you know, there's kind of a Cold War plot line. He's no longer up against the Nazis in this one. He's sort of racing these KGB agents to find a skull endowed with magical powers. Mm-hmm. But that's not a fair characterization of Soviet history in the Cold War. In the Cold War, say, communists in St. Petersburg who issued a letter of outrage. I guess the crystal skulls that they were chasing were not actually endowed with magical powers.
What?
They say, your work in this film is an insult to the Soviet and Russian people who remember the difficult 50s when our country was concluding its reconstruction after the Great War, but did not send merciless terrorists to the USA. Mm. You have no future in Russia anymore. Speaking plainly, it is better for you not to come here. You will be beaten and despised. That's a quote. Yeah, and apparently the communists there aren't the only ones with a problem with the film. Some archaeologists in Australia from the Archaeological Congress are having a problem with India as well. I think that's kind of always gone on. Claire Smith of the Congress said, Indiana Jones is an ethical nightmare. He violates international laws, runs rampant through ancient sites, in the name of glory. But nobody would have ever found the Ark of the Covenant without him. So, I mean, you can't throw out the good with the bad.
Throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Also, I think, like, you know, Indy also inspired a lot of people to become archaeologists, and they probably aren't, you know, destroying tombs and stuff. So,
I think he's done more good than bad for the world of archaeology, but
yeah.
What do I know?
Well, you don't have to get a Philly cheesesteak with Cheese Whiz. Little known fact. If you ask sandwich makers, they'll give you provolone or Swiss, but the question really is, why would you? As an article of faith, the Cheese Whiz pretty much makes the Philly cheesesteak what it's supposed to be. And it's really considered a classic Philadelphia street food. And a cheesesteak, slices of grilled beef, onions.
Am I dumb for not knowing this? Those sandwiches are made with Cheese Whiz?
You can get them with all those cheeses Matt mentioned, but I thought Cheese Whiz was the... I'm from Philly. I thought Cheese Whiz was the most popular, but I like American, so...
Yeah, well, a story in the Philly Inquirer is questioning the preeminence of Cheese Whiz. A recent Philly.com poll asked, what cheese belongs on a cheesesteak? And the Whiz finished third. American edged out provolone. There were 5,700 votes cast.
It's not even cheese.
It's considered treason, I guess. But just a little bit of reality check here. This is a little bit of history of the cheesesteak. According to the story, the first cheesesteak appeared in the 1930s. It was invented by Frank Olivieri's Uncle Pat. And it didn't have any cheese on it at all. Olivieri owns Pat's King of Steaks. And he says cheese came along in the 50s, just about when Cheese Whiz was hitting the market. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that Cheese Whiz should be the standard for the cheesesteak.
It must have been confusing for people when the cheesesteak didn't include cheese at all.
Just a steak.
Hey, guess what? It's baby jumping time in Castillo de Murcia.
I've been waiting all year.
I know.
Can I give it my best Castilian accent?
Please. Yeah.
Castillo de Murcia.
Oh, that's good.
That?
That was a good lisp.
Wow.
Thank you.
Sexy Spanish lisp.
Thank you.
Please explain.
Well, there's this annual ritual to ward off the devil. The village babies are neatly bundled close together on a mattress, and then the adult men of the community dress up as the devil to leap over the squirming babies. It's like Evel Knievel, except instead of jumping
cars,
you know, buses, yeah. You're jumping babies. And there's no motorcycle. They've been doing this since 1620.
No babies ever get hurt, does it report?
Nothing really.
No word on that.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
So it's Memorial Day, and this is a time when we remember those who have been killed in service. We have a memorial of a different stripe today, however. The inspiration for the ever-patient mommy character in the Family Circus cartoon, she died of Alzheimer's disease on Friday. Her name was Thelma Keene. She was 82 years old. Keene's husband, Bill, was the one who created that ubiquitous story of the mundane joys and misadventures of their family life through the characters of Billy, Dolly, Jeffy, PJ, and Mommy. The cartoon appears today in 1,500 newspapers. Bill Keene says he gives all the credit for his success to his wife, who became his business manager after the strip first launched in 1960. It's a lovely cartoon strip. I very rarely found it funny, but it was something that I thought was sweet, mostly. So we remember on this day Thelma Keene, who is 82 years old. Hey, folks, that's your ramble. These stories and more on our website, npr.org/Brian Park. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.